This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Michael Waldman from the Brennan Center talks about his new book, The Supermajority, How the Supreme Court Divided America.
He explains the current radical right six-person supermajority on the Supreme Court and its implications for our health, safety, and constitutional rights.
After the USA Patriot Act became law, photographing federal buildings raised alerts by law enforcement. But the practice is far from illegal. In fact, many citizens engage in what's called First Amendment auditing. We'll hear how important this is for preserving our rights to free speech and freedom of the press. Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
In late June 2022, a package of Supreme Court decisions drastically altered the nation's legal landscape. It took just 3 days to roll back some of the most consequential gains for civil rights, voting, the separation of church and state, a woman's right to choose, and more. In his new book, The Supermajority, How the Supreme Court Divided America, Michael Waldman offers an in-depth analysis of the 2022 key rulings and the radical ways in which they were crafted. He provides historical context for how the Supreme Court has amassed power far beyond what the framers intended, and how the current supermajority ascended to this high court. Waldman also points to previous courts on both the right and the left that overreached and describes their consequences for the country. Significantly, he writes that the seizure of so much power by a few members of the court and their energetic wielding of it poses a crisis for U.S. democracy. But a backlash against the court is underway. Rather than seeking a supermajority of their own, Waldman writes that, quote, liberals must fall out of love with the Supreme Court. He recommends reform measures to curb the court's power while applying other pressure points, such as in the court of public opinion. Michael Waldman is the president and CEO of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School, a nonpartisan law and policy institute. An expert on the Constitution and the courts, Waldman served on President Joe Biden's commission on the Supreme Court. He is the author of The Fight to Vote and The Second Amendment, a biography. Michael Waldman was director of speechwriting during the Clinton administration. Michael Waldman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
Michael, congratulations on your new book. We wanted to start by noting that although the Supreme Court is officially the Roberts Court, you say that ideologically it's the Thomas Court. Can you please explain?
Well, John Roberts, we assign his name to the court as a matter of historical convenience, and he holds the gavel. But in a lot of significant ways, Clarence Thomas holds the power and has the influence. There's now a 6-vote supermajority of the 9, of very conservative justices, by and large working in lockstep. And Thomas's approach, which is not to pay much attention to precedent, to claim that he's only following originalism, to disdain the impact and public reaction to rulings, has been what has dominated the most significant rulings of the past year and probably more to come.
Michael, why do you refer to the court's last term as radical? Could you cite some examples of some of the right-wing court's most egregious rulings recently?
The supermajority, this group of justices, this faction of a faction that now has the power in this court, their first full year ended in June 2022. And in the last 3 days of the term, they put forward 3 rulings that were really radical in different ways and really significant with huge potential impact on millions of people's lives. The first was the Bruin case, which was by far the most sweeping Second Amendment ruling in the country's history, sort of not even a close call, that basically said that courts cannot consider public safety when they're looking at gun rules, only, quote, history and tradition, what was done back in the founding era. The next day was the Dobbs ruling. This overturned Roe v. Wade, as your listeners no doubt know, and ended the half a century of protection of abortion rights in the federal constitution and put all the other privacy rights at risk too. And the day after that, the last day of the term, was a case that didn't get as much attention called West Virginia versus EPA. And this was the opening salvo on what is clearly going to be a really major effort to curb the power of the federal government to act to protect the environment, public safety, and these kinds of regulatory matters. They crammed decades of social change into those 3 days. And, you know, the law didn't change. The facts didn't change. What changed was the personnel on the court, and the consequences are pretty visible to all of us.
In its recent decision in Glacier Northwest v. Teamsters, as you know, the court weakened the right to strike. And you just referred to this, but do you think the court will further erode the authority of administrative agencies to regulate labor, health, safety, and the environment? And what might that look like?
I think very much so. In the early part of the 20th century, the ideological Supreme Court of that era saw its role as being stopping government from acting to protect women, to protect public safety and workers and the like. And this, among other things, led to the big conflict with Franklin Roosevelt and the court packing fight. But one of the things that happened in 1937 is that the conservative justices of that day backed down. They said they were not going to try to limit the general ability of the federal government to regulate the economy nationwide. A lot of libertarians, a lot of business interests have thought, oh, that was a bad, bad thing that happened, and have tried to come up with some way to persuade earlier generations of Supreme Courts to cut back on the power of the federal government, unsuccessfully until last June. Last June, the court said in the, first of all, that a regulatory agency, in that case it was the EPA, could not act even if Congress had passed legislation with language, in effect giving it the power to act. They could not act if it was a, quote, major question. Meaning if it was important enough, Congress had to do it, the regulators could not. Now the Supreme Court has taken a case where they're going to, in the next term, consider something called the Chevron Doctrine, which is basically a rule that conservatives on the court over many years pushed that gives the experts in regulatory agencies basically the first say on what an ambiguous law passed by Congress means, that judges are not going to second guess these experts on these technical matters. And these cases and the more cases that are coming suggest pretty strongly that when it comes to big, visible, high-profile issues like abortion or guns, that's one thing. But these are the cases that are very technical, that don't get as much attention, but that mean a lot of money to a lot of people. And they're going to work hard, it seems, to impose a particular ideological view of what the role and shape and size of the federal government ought to be by claiming that they're doing it based on constitutional rulings. So I think this is going to be a big, big part of the story going forward.
Michael, Gorsuch, Thomas, and Alito favor the deconstruction of the administrative state. Could you explain for our listeners what that is and why do conservatives eschew regulation?
Well, the administrative state is part of our modern way of life, part of our modern government. It's the idea that there are some issues that are quite technical and where you can't expect judges or even legislators to have all the details. And understand all the science and understand all the changes that go on. So when Congress over many decades, created these agencies, agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, which polices fraud on Wall Street, or other agencies like that. Congress gave the agencies a lot of authority to decide what to do. And they have procedures. They have, you have to have public hearings. There's all kinds of rules about how these agencies act. But that's how we have safe cars. That's how we have safe drinking water. That's how we have workplace safety or the ability to organize a union or all these other things that are protected by these administrative agencies. They call it the administrative state. Now, why do Gorsuch and Thomas and Alito not like this? Well, they say, oh, it's because it takes away the power from the elected officials who should be making these decisions, the democratically accountable officials. And of course, those officials voted to give this power to these expert agencies. I think that more broadly, the legal conservative movement isn't as focused on who has the power, but that the government should not intrude in the marketplace. They do not want the kind of regulation of environmental protection that these agencies sometimes put forward. They don't want the policing of Wall Street and so on. It's the same fight you see in Congress. It's the same fight you see in other realms. Now it's playing out in the courts, and they're trying to find a constitutional argument with these very conservative justices in there. And Gorsuch and Thomas and Alito, in different ways, but especially Gorsuch and especially Thomas, have basically said that they think that the rulings in the 1930s that allowed the federal government to create a national modern economy were really wrong. As I write in the book, The Supermajority, that in Gorsuch's case, this is pretty interesting because it's actually carrying on a family crusade. His mother, Ann Gorsuch, was a very well-known sort of flamboyant figure in the 1980s. She was the second highest ranking woman in the Reagan administration. She was the head of the EPA, and she was very charismatic. She was very close to industry. She put people from the industry in charge of the EPA. It was nonstop scandal, nonstop controversy. She eventually was held in contempt of Congress and forced out of her job. And in her memoir at the time, she talks about her teenage son, Neil, saying, well, you know, Mom, you didn't raise me to be a quitter. Why are you being a quitter? But basically, the liberals getting his mom driven out of Washington was the childhood trauma for Neil Gorsuch. We all have our traumas. That was his. Of course, it's a little less dramatic what he's doing, but in a sense, it's the same goal of curbing the power of government to regulate business.
So fascinating. Michael, you also wrote a book in 2016, The Fight to Vote, on the long struggle to secure the right to vote for all Americans. With the case of Merrill v. Milligan, concerning Alabama's redrawn congressional maps, now pending before the court, what's your prediction about future protections for voting rights? And we know the Brennan Center follows this closely.
Well, over the years, the Supreme Court and the federal courts even were never the main place where voting rights victories happened and where voting rights protection was implemented. Far more of the strong protection of voting rights came from things like the Voting Rights Act, which was passed by Congress, signed into law by a president, and won with the blood and courage and sacrifice of demonstrators like John Lewis and the others in Selma in 1965. Over the course of history, there just have not been so many, you know, rock'em sock'em big, you know, transformative wins for voting rights at the Supreme Court. What's been different in the past decade and a half, and this is something where John Roberts has led the way. He may not be as conservative, say, as Clarence Thomas, but on the issues of democracy, he's just as much of an activist and just as pointed, I would argue, in the wrong direction. The Supreme Court has, in a series of rulings, gone out of its way to demolish the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was the most effective civil rights law, in many ways, on the books. And in 2013, in the Shelby County case, they basically rendered inoperative the key part of that law, which was that states with a history of discrimination in voting needed to get permission from the Justice Department or a federal court to change voting rules. That was called Section 5. But there was something else called Section 2 that wasn't as good, but you could sue after the fact to challenge discriminatory voting laws. And 2 years ago, in a case called Brnovich, they basically said, no, you can't really use that very easily to challenge voter suppression, to challenge the newfangled types of voting laws, so many of them coming out of the big lie, out of the Trump's argument that the election was stolen and that sort of thing. Merrill v. Milligan, it's actually the name of the case has changed, but it's the same case, looks at Section 2 and the use that Section 2 has had for decades, which is to stop gerrymandering on racial grounds, stop drawing of district lines in a way that dilutes the political power and effective vote for black people and other communities of color and minority communities. There is, at the moment we are talking, we don't know what the outcome will be, but based on the lineup of the court, based on the fact that John Roberts has a bee in his bonnet about the Voting Rights Act, I am not optimistic that there's going to be much left of the law when this court is done.
Very, very disturbing indeed, Michael. Why do you think liberals have largely fallen silent in challenging the court's shift to the radical right?
I think that's changing, but I think you're right that that has been too much of the case, too much of the time. Until quite recently, public approval in the polls of the Supreme Court was much higher for Democrats and liberals than for conservatives and Republicans, despite Shelby County, despite Citizens United, and so many of these other rulings. Some of that, I think, is the long afterglow of the Warren Court, which was the one time in the court's history, one time in the country's history, that the court has been, was ahead of the country, and was in some ways too aggressive in being ahead of the country as opposed to being a reactionary force. And we are still living in that backlash. For a long time, conservatives organized, conservatives criticized the court. They made sure their candidates would pledge to focus on the Supreme Court, and Democrats and liberals, progressives did not. I think that is changing. I mean, I think in the aftermath of Dobbs especially, we've seen a significant backlash, a significant electoral consequence of this court's radicalism. And I think that that's going to change, but I think it has to change. I think that, you know, even President Biden, he has been pretty strong, actually, about appointing judges and actually getting judges onto the bench. But he has not spoken out about the court, not used his bully pulpit, and I think that's a mistake.
Michael, some critics propose packing the court with more liberal jurists. Why do you think this is unlikely to happen, and what are its drawbacks?
So it's certainly constitutional. It's certainly legal. Congress has expanded and contracted the size of the court before. A lot of people don't realize that. They kind of assume that 9 is in the Constitution. Is it a good idea? The idea of expanding the court, you know, in that way certainly comes, for example, after the what a lot of us regard as a stolen seat when Mitch McConnell and the Republicans simply refused to even consider President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland for a full year, just to raw politics, just because they could. The worries about court expansion include that it would be instantly turning into a retaliatory spiral where the Democrats add 5 and then the Republicans add 5. But also that there's a risk that it would look illegitimate to a lot of people who actually are appalled by the court. Franklin Roosevelt, you know, when he proposed that, it was defeated. And it was in the middle of the Great Depression. They had just struck down the first New Deal. They were getting ready to rule on Social Security and on the labor laws and other really popular big things. Roosevelt had just won the biggest electoral victory ever up until that point, and he had 70% of the Senate in his own party, and even he found that the pushback, which was unexpected from a sort of an invisible majority, was too intense. The court backed down as well, but Roosevelt's political coalition was shattered by it. So those are the downsides. The upside is that if the court continues in the reckless and extreme direction that it's in now, I think there'll be more people calling for it. I really believe that the best answer is to impose an 18-year term limit on Supreme Court justices. That is the idea that no person should have too much power for too long. It is pretty much reflective of the insight that George Washington had when he was president, that he stepped down after two terms. And it's an interesting thing. It's very popular with Democrats and Republicans. You know, every state Supreme Court but one, for example, has either term limits or an age, a retirement age. So do the constitutional courts in other countries. I was a member of a presidential commission on the U.S. Supreme Court that President Biden appointed in 2021. And these commissions, you know, they're sort of notorious for not doing much of anything. And we were actually instructed before we gathered not to reach conclusions. It actually was in the public instructions to the commission. And we didn't. It was a government agency that worked, finally, as intended. But something really interesting happened. We heard from dozens of public witnesses from left and right. And they disagreed on a lot of things. Some people wanted court expansion, others didn't. Some people wanted a code of ethics, others didn't. One after another, though, they said, oh, but I support term limits. There's actually, when you look at who supports it, when you look at public opinion, there's a broad public support for term limits, for making it so that each president can make a nomination every 2 years, which I hope would drain the poison to some degree out of the nominations process. Now, how could you do it? You certainly could do it with a constitutional amendment. I think you could do it as well through a statute. The Supreme Court in the past has upheld things like that. So I think it's going to happen. I think that I'm not under any illusion that, you know, as wide as the support is right now, if it ever gets to that point, undoubtedly there'll be more polarization. But I think it can be done in a way that wins broad support.
Michael, as we head toward 2024, how do you think the Supreme Court's right-wing overreaching will impact the election?
You know, history offers a bit of a lesson here. I think it'll have a big impact. In the country's history, when there's been a period of overreach, there's been a backlash. When the court has been, usually the Supreme Court kind of hugs the middle. It kind of reflects the political consensus. But when it's been unduly partisan or extreme or unduly activist, there's a significant response, organizing, agitation, even electoral realignment. And we're seeing a very significant response to this Supreme Court already. In the 2022 midterm elections, usually those go really badly for whoever the party is that controls the White House. The Democrats this time had the best midterm election in decades. And that was a response to Dobbs, to the Dobbs ruling, and to fears for democracy, all kind of conflated in a lot of people's mind as worrying about extremism. Even more striking to me was the Wisconsin State Supreme Court election in April, where, you know, Wisconsin's kind of a very evenly divided state. The electorate is evenly divided. And usually these races are very close. And it turned into an 11-point win for the more liberal candidate. And it was a referendum, basically, on the direction of the courts and on Dobbs and on abortion rights. And, you know, political scientists will tell you that's kind of an earthquake. You don't get that big a shift. So I think it's going to be a big issue in 2024. I think it won't just be on the Republican side, which has often been the way it's been up until now, but on the Democratic side as well. And I don't know how it will play out, of course, but I think that this is now going to be a central political debate going forward, as it should be.
Michael, in our last 2 minutes, you write the conservatives know that the best way to correct overreach is through public pressure. How do you recommend that progressives and liberals do that?
By talking about it, by voting about it, by demanding that candidates tell them what kind of justices they're going to appoint and how much pressure, how much priority, rather, they're going to place on this, just the way the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation and conservatives have done for years and years. We can push back with constitutional amendments. We can push back by encouraging Congress to act. For example, Congress has the power to restore the strength of the Voting Rights Act, because it was an interpretation of a statute, and the legislation that passed the House of Representatives and had a majority support in the Senate, the Freedom to Vote John Lewis Act last year, came achingly close to enactment that way. But they couldn't overcome a filibuster, even though they had a majority of the Senate. The Senate needs to end the filibuster for those kinds of bills so you can have action. People need to march. People need to vote. People need to speak out. Conservatives understood, and liberals maybe once again are learning, the court that matters, the court where you really can win meaningful change, is the court of public opinion. It turns out that the most important words in the dense text of the Constitution are the first three, we the people.
Well, as we wrap up here, Michael, how can our listeners follow your work and that of the Brennan Center?
Well, I hope folks will read The Supermajority. It's important, I think, that those arguments about the court get a wide audience. We also, at the Brennan Center, have content-rich newsletters, electronic newsletters. One that I write every week called The Briefing comes out on a Tuesday. No spam, lots of nutrition. You can go to BrennanCenter.org/briefing. You can sign up. But if you go to the Brennan Center website, BrennanCenter.org, you can sign up for our newsletters and find out our work on a very regular basis.
Michael, thank you so much for this really important book, The Supermajority. We hope our listeners will read it. And thank you for the great work that the Brennan Center has done over the years.
Tremendous. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Restrictions began after the New York Civil Liberties Union looked into several cases of people who were harassed, detained, and arrested by federal agents while photographing or shooting video of federal buildings from the vantage points of public plazas and sidewalks. In 2010, the New York Civil Liberties Union brought a suit against the U.S. Department of Homeland Security in federal court, challenging its practice of arresting photographers. In October of that year, a settlement was reached in which the U.S. government agreed that no federal statutes or regulations bar people from photographing the exterior of federal buildings, and the government issued a directive to members of the Federal Protective Service on photographers' rights. A decade later, these rights are being put to the test in a practice known by some as First Amendment audits. We're joined by one such First Amendment auditor whose popular YouTube channel is called Big Nick South Florida Accountability. With view counts in the millions, Nicholas Freeman joins us to talk about his work in Fort Lauderdale, where he's part of an emerging trend to educate local law enforcement about the public's right to photography. Nick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
thank you so much for having me. I'm honored and I appreciate it so much.
Nick, tell our listeners about your community in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and why you decided to become a First Amendment auditor.
Okay. Like many African Americans in America, I grew up in an impoverished part of my community. Even though my background was low middle class to middle class, you know, eventually I did wind up bleeding over into the lesser impoverished areas. Well, what led me to become to actually pick up a camera and started doing what I do was a couple of years ago, Stephon Clark was in the news. That was a young man, I believe, in Washington that was shot by the cops in his grandmother's backyard by holding up his cell phone. Now, I had always been a little upset about the treatment that my community were receiving from those that were sworn to serve and protect. I just didn't know how to express it, how to deal with it, how to fight back, till I came across the Stephon Clark story. And I was just, to be honest with you, I was just really, really upset. And I wanted to go on YouTube, and I just wanted to find black people running away from cops and getting away, you know, like making cops run after them and they couldn't catch them and getting away. And I stumbled across some channels that was doing exactly what I'm doing. And I started watching them and I started being intrigued by them and really felt drawn to it. And one day I just decided, you know what? The police department is a couple of blocks away. Let me just grab my camera, go out and just see the response that I would get. And the response was exactly what I thought it would be. And it just opened up a whole can of worms for them.
I've heard the phrase, eyes don't trespass. What does that mean when auditors use that?
Meaning, as long as I'm on somewhere I'm supposed to be, you cannot stop me from looking at anything as long as I'm in public. You can't make me turn my head. You can't make me walk in another direction. I can see anything that my eyes will focus on. So you can't trespass my eyes, even if it's on private property. If it's visible from the public's view, I'm allowed to look at it.
Nick, walk us through, if you will, a typical confrontation with a police officer who asks to see your identification, even though you're filming in a public area.
Okay, well, the first thing we do, well, that's an intimidation tactic. For them to let you know that they have authority and power. So the first thing they would do is they'd come up and ask you, hey, what's going on? What are you doing? And of course, you know, if you don't feel like answering them, you don't have to answer them because you do have the Fifth Amendment right in this country. So if you know, you don't want to answer them, the next step would be, well, do you have any ID? And that's always an intimidation tactic. So once they ask for ID, me being knowledgeable in my state, penal code for presenting ID, always remind them that, you know, in Florida, unless I'm suspected of committing a crime, I'm about to commit a crime, or I'm in the process of committing a crime, I have absolutely no obligation or duty to present any type of information to you. And besides that, we have the Fourth Amendment right in America where, you know, we're to be secure in our papers and effects.
Do you get the line from police officers specifically that you're engaging in, quote, suspicious activity? And how do you respond to that?
All the time. Suspicious activity is just a way for them to curtail around the Fourth Amendment. And my response to that would be a suspicion of misdemeanor or felony.
What response do you get from police officers? Does that get them angrier or do they specifically answer you?
They specifically answer me, but you can still tell they're dumbfounded because the answer is always, well, it's neither. And once they acknowledge that it's neither, and then the law shields me and they can see the shield coming completely around me. Because if I'm not breaking the law and you're a law enforcer, you have absolutely no purpose at this point.
Nick, do you ever get a response from civilians who may be sometimes upset that they're included in whatever you are photographing or videoing? And what do you say to them?
Once I let them know that, you know, I'm not here to record them, that I'm only here to record public officials, and their interactions with the public. If that doesn't work, then I would try to let them know that there's no expectation of privacy in public, meaning if you're out in public, you know what? My eyes can't trespass. I can look at you. I can record you. If that doesn't work, then I would typically point out the many, many, many cameras that is in the area, buildings, in a particular location. And I would try to let them know that statistics show they walk under no less than 3,000 cameras per day.
And you're talking about surveillance cameras that are literally everywhere we may walk.
Absolutely. And I would ask you a question. When you walk into a building or you walk past a building, does those people ask your permission to record you?
No, they don't. Very good point. I'm curious, have you ever been roughed up by the police, or have they ever tried to take away your camera from you?
I have not been roughed up, knock on wood, but I have been arrested 6 times for my activism. I have 6 acquittals because I don't cop out. I take it to trial each time. I've had my equipment taken all 6 times, and the longest it's been taken has been about 6 months. I've literally spent thousands of dollars to replace equipment that has been held in evidence.
I would imagine that you are a familiar face to many law enforcement officers. Do you think that many of them know who you are?
I would say 100% of them know who I am. Even the agencies in South Florida that I hadn't visited, when I did visit, they already was aware as to who I am and what it is that I do. And, you know, it is a blessing and a curse now, because the blessing is that now that they understand who I am and what I do, that I'm allowed to do something that I have the right to do, if that makes sense. They now allow me to do something that I've always had the right to do, without any type of confrontation or harassment. However, to me, they're putting their best foot forward because it's me. But I still get information from, you know, the public that, hey, these cops are doing this, these cops are doing that. And I wonder if they're doing it because they know I'm not around. So to me, it's like it's a double-edged sword to me.
Nick, can you tell listeners about the Department of Homeland Security case where plaintiff Antonio Musumeci was arrested in November 2009 after recording with a handheld video camera a protester in a public plaza outside the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Federal Courthouse in Manhattan?
Yes. That case was a very interesting case to me because it did set, well, it didn't even set precedent. It just reaffirmed that was already American right to do so, to be a member of the free press, which means you're allowed to go out and you're allowed to observe, you're allowed to redress your government and peacefully protest in the manner that you see fit. However, once that happened, the Department of Homeland Security, the Federal Protective Services, put out a memo that auditors such as myself now routinely refer to. You would see it in your local post office. You would see it in your federal courthouses. We refer to it as Poster 7, where the Department of Homeland Security made it an edict to put it in each and every one of the federal locations. That is open to the public, that public photography for news purposes can be taken in hallways, foyers, courtyards, anywhere that the public is permitted. So by him being arrested, basically he did what auditors are doing now, is telling these law enforcement officers or agencies to know your job that you're doing. You took an oath to the Constitution. Don't just take the oath, read the Constitution. Read your memos, understand your briefings. You know, follow up on your information that you're receiving so you can better protect the public.
Why is it important to document the different types of reactions that you may get from law enforcement officers during a First Amendment audit?
Well, they make up laws. They make up laws that you're invading privacy, or you need my permission to record my image, that this is county property, without understanding that county property is public property because there's no person named county. The people make up the county. The public makes up the county. So They say things like, this is public property, or, I mean, this is county property, this is the sheriff's office department property. You can't record in the courthouse lobby. With the rules states you can't record in the courtrooms. It's a lot of wordplay. If you're not familiar with what they're doing, you will allow them to dominate and dictate your actions. And, you know, that defeats the purpose of what you're doing.
I understand that sometimes federal employees who work in these buildings, their reaction may be even worse sometimes than law enforcement reaction. Can you give us an example of that? And is this an important learning lesson for those employees?
It is absolutely important learning lesson for those employees, because even though they're not the enforcement part of the government, they're the representatives of the government. They're the direct link from the public to the government itself. And those are the people who should be the most knowledgeable of the things that the public should be able to have access to when it comes to a public place, a public building, public ownership of this said establishment. Say, for instance, the post office, the postal service. That is one of the most public places in America. You know, it's open to each and every individual who's in America. And these people should know that this poster that is completely displayed, prominently displayed on their poster board, allows people like myself to come in and observe them in their work or place of work, to see where my tax dollars are going to make sure that I am being represented in the way that I should be. But they're completely unaware. I like to refer to people like that as three categories of people like that. You have the one that really want to serve the public. You have the people that want to assert authority. And you have the people that want paychecks and pensions. And the paychecks and pensions are 70% of the problem. That's all they come to work for, a paycheck and pension. They don't care about the public. They don't care about community service. The only thing they want to do is come clock in, clock out, and after 20 years, live off the tax dollars for the rest of their lives.
I understand that you have a category called tyrant alert. Can you talk about some of the kinds of physical abuse police or even others engage in during First Amendment audits?
Yes. Well, the biggest problem is the threat of arrest. We consider that in the auditing community a threat of violence, because if you're going to arrest me, that means you're going to grab me, you're going to place me in shackles, you're going to move me against my will. To me and to other auditors, that's violence. That's violence against me. Plus, you're heavily armed. You have a death belt, what we refer to. And at any point, my life is in your hand, and you can decide whether I live or die. So, you know, they would grab you. They would illegally detain you. They would, you know, try to force you to sit on the ground, to stop talking, to try to tell you exactly how the situation is going to play out, which it should be the other way around. The analogy I like to use is law enforcement or government work is the only employment in America where the employee treats the employer as the lesser of the two. See, I always refer to the term public servant. And the most prevalent line of that public servant is the servant part. Every servant has a master. Maybe harsh to say, but they're the ones who label themselves public servants. So which makes the public the masters. But it's the only occupation in America where the servant dictates to the master.
Yes, and where the servant is empowered to use force, including lethal force.
Absolutely. I mean, if you go to a local restaurant, say, you know, fast food chain, and the employee talks to the manager in that manner, the first thing the manager would do was clock out and go home. Mm. You know, but in public, we can't tell law enforcement to clock out and go home. You're no longer needed. You know, they have one of the strongest unions in America, you know, and they do everything they can to keep these people in power. So a tyrant is someone who goes above and beyond his call of duty just to enforce his will on you.
Nick, what is the walk of shame?
The walk of shame is when they come up with their chest all puffed out, breathing fire out of their noses, and the law hits them right in the face, and they turn around, and they have to walk away without doing anything that they originally set out to accomplish.
Tell us about the positive effects that First Amendment audits have done to improve police relations in your community.
Well, it has empowered the public with knowledge to understand that I'm not just, I can speak from my point of view. I am very proud to be who I am. I'm very proud to be an African-American in America. I served my country proudly, 6 years in the military. But being a citizen of America has gotten everything. So what First Amendment auditors have done is enlighten people to understand that their citizenship vastly outweighs their race. And once they take advantage and understand the power that they have in being a citizen of the United States, that, you know, they are the ones that are called the shot. They're the ones that protect their community. They're the ones that take these ill-informed people who we entrust with our public safety. I know myself personally, I have touched millions of people. I get messages all the time about how my information has saved them, how they're going to be more knowledgeable and then find the knowledge to do what I do. So it's the information that they're receiving from me that makes me know that I am making a difference.
You have inspired many others to begin launching their own auditing channels on YouTube. What advice do you have for others who want to follow in your footsteps, Nick?
To be themselves, and also to stand firm, to be willing to take that ride. You know, I tell people all the time, a lot of problems that Americans have is that we have gotten to the point where if it don't affect me, I'm going to stay out of it. But I'm willing to take that ride so you don't have to take that ride. So you have to stand firm. You have to stand pat. You have to know what you're doing is for the greater good and that it's bigger than you. That's the first thing I had to do was understand that what I am doing is bigger than me. When I first became popular and I was getting all these accolades and people was contacting me, it went to my head. I almost had celebrity status. But because of my upbringing and the people that I have in my life, I quickly humbled myself to realize that what I'm doing is really affecting other people, and this is now bigger than I am. So the advice I would give people is to stand firm, be strong, and be willing to be a martyr, so the person next to you don't have to be one.
Nick, we're going to play one or two video compilations made from your encounters. So we're going to pause to listen to a few minutes from one right now.
Okay.
What's your name and your badge number?
Officer Pitts, 3199.
Thank you. Hey, what's your name and your badge number?
Hold on. What's your name, sir? What is your name?
What crime do you suspect me of committing?
They want to trespass warrant you, which they have the right to do
right.
Throughout their train.
So I don't need to get my name.
I'm trying to
warrant.
Talk to you.
All right.
First of all,
I don't want to talk though.
They need your
what's
identification.
Your name is, no.
They for the form. Yes, they do.
No. Your name is, no.
They for the form. Yes, they do. They for the form. Yes, they do.
No. By they law. Told me to leave. I left by law.
By
I left.
Law,
you can warn me.
I need your information to put in my system of trust.
No, I'm not. What crime do you suspect me of committing?
Trespassing. And I'm asking you for your information so I can write into
what
my
crime?
System.
What crime? Articulate a crime.
From the train station.
Okay, they told me to leave,
sir,
and I left. So what crime did I commit?
You have to
absolutely not. Yes. 901.151
yes.
States
give
different.
Give me your name, please.
Florida Penal Code states different.
I'm asking for your name.
Okay.
Name and date of birth, sir.
I'm not giving you my name.
What is your name and date of birth?
What's your name and your badge number?
Don't give it to him.
You have to.
No, I just get you mine.
You're
I'm the primary,
contact.
Sir. I'm the primary.
Okay, so why are they here?
Because they're my backup.
Okay,
and I'm the
I need their names.
My
in case
no.
You violate my rights, I need
well,
to know
I'm asking
who to
for your
contact.
ID for their form.
And I'm not giving
it's
it.
Gonna be Sergeant
they asked me to leave. They asked me to leave, and I left. Okay, so you don't need my information.
Do.
So you don't need, no,
do.
I'm not giving them my information. Florida Penal Code 901.
See this?
Florida Penal Code says that I don't care.
It states that you need to provide them.
First, you need to warn me what you're doing now, and I'm not on it.
I have nothing to do with it.
Good. So I'm not, you can't force me to give them.
Hold on, let me talk.
You can't force me to give my ID without breaking the law.
Well, when the police officer asks for identification,
that's not what Florida Penal Code 901.151 states. It states suspicion of a crime, about to commit a crime, or have committed a crime.
You can hold your phone, please.
Am I being detained?
Well, right now, yes, you are.
For what crime?
For trespassing.
Okay. I'm not a trespasser. I'm talking to you.
Okay.
I need the sergeant, please.
Sergeant's coming, sir.
Thank you. And so you told them not to identify to a citizen, right?
No. You told them. You're dealing with me. I'm the primary.
But they're here.
No, they have nothing to do with it.
They're
they responded to dispatch.
First of all, why are you so loud? Back up a little bit.
I'm right here.
Okay, but back up a little bit.
Because you're right next to me.
No, you walked up to me. Okay, I'm going to step a step back. I'm going to take a step back. Now, am I being detained?
Yes, you're still being detained for questions. What took place on the train?
And since I'm being detained, then at this point, I like to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege.
My God.
I like to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege.
Oh, my God. What took place on the train that they didn't want to trespass on you? That's what we're asking.
I don't know. Investigate them.
I did. I already talked to her. But okay. I want your side of the story. Instead of,
I don't have a side.
There's two sides of the story, right?
I don't have a side. I don't answer questions, buddy.
You don't answer questions?
No.
Okay, but you have to provide ID.
No, I don't.
For an investigation, yes, you do.
Suspicion of a crime, I'm about to commit a crime,
well,
how I committed a crime.
I have it with
901.151.
I know what it is, sir.
I'm an activist.
I know.
And you know I don't have to give you my information.
I see.
You know I don't have to give you my information. So all
you,
that, when a police...
First of all, you have your name for the form. For the
no, I don't. Because, no, they asked me to leave, and I left. I know the law. I'm very well versed in the law.
Okay.
They told me to leave, and I left.
Okay.
So that's my
very
warning.
First.
I'm very versed in the law.
Ask you, they want to put you in a system, so when we have to deal with you again, if we do, it's already there, sir.
Then that's when you get it. Yeah, if I break the law, that's when you get
it. No, we put it now. So
no, I don't like giving my name to the government for nothing.
How do you get checks? For paid, stuff like that.
I said for nothing.
For nothing, but for anything, right? So
I don't like giving my information to the government for just randomly.
Stop yelling at me.
I'm not. I can yell. I can talk. Freedom of speech.
I'm asking you to stop yelling at me.
Do you feel threatened?
I kind of do.
Okay, then you can go.
I can't go, honestly.
You can go.
Believe me, I wish I could.
Okay.
Sir, I, this guy does this all the time.
I shake your hand, Sergeant.
I know.
So you're not going to shake my hand, Sergeant? You're not going to say Hanson, what's your badge number, Hanson?
3065.
Thank you.
Hanson, 3065.
Let your dog know.
I'm not a dog, number one. I'm not a dog, number one.
Let your dog know.
I'm not a dog,
that he can't attack me.
You
look at it.
I'm not a dog.
Hey, back
I'm
off from a taxpaying law-abiding citizen.
I'm an officer.
Do not
officer.
Intimidate
you're
a law. You're not
I'm
acting
not,
like a law.
No,
you're not acting like an officer. No, you trying to
I'm
demand me to give my
I'm
information to them.
They need it for their report.
I don't care. And I'm telling you, you're trying to. That's not true, Sergeant. You hear what he's saying, Sergeant? When an officer asks me my name, I have to give it to him.
If you're being detained, you are.
Yes.
No, I have to be legally detained.
But you do this so often, we actually know who
you are. I have to be lawfully detained.
Have a nice day.
Lawfully detained.
Stay out of my face.
I'm not in your face. You just came right here.
Stay out of my face.
Look, see how your feet move and kick rocks.
Nick, how can our listeners follow your work?
Well, you can follow me on YouTube. It's Big Nick. South Florida Accountability. That's on YouTube. And on Instagram, it's all together, is Big Nick South Florida. And on YouTube is my surname, Nick Freeman.
Nick Freeman on Facebook. Nick, it's really been a pleasure to spend a few minutes with you. We want to thank you for the critically important work that you do and wish you the best in safety as you're out on the streets exercising your First Amendment rights. Thank you so much.
I thank you so much for having me. And with a parting shot, if I can just have your listeners to remember, always record your interactions with the government.
Words to the wise. Nick, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. Be safe.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
on